Inshallah, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Inshallah means God willing in Arabic, and saying it got a passenger thrown off a flight recently. But this Arabic speaker says there's nothing threatening about the phrase as it's commonly used here.
Like, man, did you see her? Inshallah, bro. Inshallah, one day maybe I can talk to her. Translation, I have no hopes of ever acquiring their phone number, but God willing, maybe I can get it.
Also, what it's like to visit the illegal gold mines in Peru and talk to exploited workers there.
There is just no way out for them.
Plus, looking for a Russian war veteran whose image went viral.
He's wearing a load of medals on his chest. He's wiping a tear from his eye. He's clearly very emotional.
Those stories ahead on The World. We're going to start off with a story that got our attention this week. It's about a college student who was booted off a Southwest Airlines flight for speaking Arabic. Karaldin Makhzoumi is a senior at UC Berkeley and a refugee from Iraq. Southwest Airlines says it took him off a jet that was about to leave Los Angeles earlier this month because another passenger heard him make, quote, threatening comments on his phone. Among the things that disturbed her was hearing Makhzoumi use the word inshallah, meaning God willing. Makhzoumi has no plans to take legal action against Southwest, but he does want the airline to apologize for the way he was treated. Writer, journalist, and attorney Wajahat Ali has been thinking about this case, and he wonders where it could all lead.
Every time you go to the supermarket, to Whole Foods, and maybe order some tahini, hummus, or falafel, you might be engaging in some potentially dangerous activities that could get you kicked out of a supermarket.
But he says, in all seriousness, the Berkeley student's treatment is a sign of what happens when fear and hate go mainstream.
Otherwise, well-intentioned people who mean well are terrified by things that they should instead embrace, like inshallah, which is a very convenient and useful phrase that is used in the vernacular of many communities, not just Muslim communities. And the one good thing is maybe inshallah can be mainstreamed and God willing enters our vocabulary.
Now, I know you posted on Facebook some examples of how inshallah is used. Can you give us some of those?
Inshallah can be used literally as God willing. God willing, may the lamb be tasty. Inshallah. Another way is oftentimes single people use it like, man, did you see her? Inshallah, bro. Inshallah, one day maybe I can talk to her. Translation, this is an aesthetically pleasing female and or male. I have no hopes of ever acquiring their phone number, but God willing, maybe I can get it. If you're a father, I'm now a father. I used to say this to my dad when I was a kid. Father, can we go to Toys R Us? And your dad turns to you and goes, yes, inshallah. Translation, we're never going to Toys R Us today. You can keep your delusions. If you're a wedding attendee, hey, will this event actually start at 2 p.m. at the wedding planner? Yes, inshallah. Translation, come at 3 p.m. or you'll be the loser sitting eating the hummus dip all by yourself.
Now, you mentioned that the word inshallah might be able to be mainstreamed. I'd love to hear some examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, like when I was going to law school, essentially most of my friends were non-Muslim and they heard me drop inshallah like all the time and they used inshallah. For example, bro, inshallah, I passed the bar exam. Inshallah, inshallah. And that's a double inshallah. That's like a two-action inshallah pump, which like literally makes you like invoke all the celestial powers that hopefully you can pass the bar exam.
By some accounts, there have been at least six other incidents of Muslims being ejected from U.S. flights since the start of the year. Are you going to start changing how you act on planes?
Unless I wear Fair and Lovely cream and change my name to Walter from Mujahid, I really don't know how to change myself, right? Like I unfortunately exude very American-y, Muslim-y, and Pakistani vibes. I have lentil stains on my shirt. I apparently have American swagger. And I drop inshallah like 47 times a day. So maybe if I sit still, I don't blink, and I smile a really white teeth smile, that'll be the way I'll be most neutralized and safe. But God forbid if I did that, I would probably end up terrifying everyone even more. So I have absolutely no idea how to behave. Maybe Southwest Airlines can give all Arabic-speaking passengers a nice guideline on how to behave to make other people feel safe. I can do a Bollywood dance. Maybe before sitting down, you know, maybe we can all eat hummus because apparently hummus is now mainstream. Maybe I can talk about the Warriors and NBA sports. If that means, unfortunately, scrubbing my skin color, probably not going to happen. And if that means me giving up my beloved inshallah, which, as you guys have been hearing, is a great, glorious tool that can be used by all communities. I think, unfortunately, I will be deemed a threat for the rest of my life.
But seriously, do you ever find yourself on a plane or on mass transit of any sort, and maybe even subconsciously altering what you say or what you do? I mean, have you ever noticed that maybe you don't say inshallah as much, or am I just reaching here?
No, you're not reaching. Unfortunately, this is a situation where even a person like myself, I think anyone who can hear this conversation realizes I'm very proud of my identity. Due to the climate that we're living in, you become much more conscious and self-conscious. So you think twice, you know, should I speak in Urdu and drop a lot of Arabic when I see eyeballs staring at me at the plane? Should I take out the latest book I'm reading about ISIS on the plane? Because I'm literally reading a book on ISIS. You know, oftentimes after 9/11, what I do is when I walk down the aisle, you know, I end up smiling and nodding my head to make some of these passengers feel safer, because I can see from their eyes, they give me double glances. And so I go out of my way to make a passenger I've never met before feel a little bit safer, just so they won't, God forbid, report me and I can have an easier time on the plane.
Wajaha Ali is a writer, journalist, and attorney. He is currently creative director at Affinis Labs. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wajaha and I had a lot more to talk about than we could get on the show today, so we've put the entire interview up on our Twitter account, at PRI The World. It's definitely worth a listen. Now, when Pope Francis made a quick trip to the Greek island of Lesbos this past weekend, he didn't come home alone. He brought along three Syrian refugee families who are seeking asylum in Europe. The families were chosen ahead of time by the Vatican, which is covering their expenses, and they're staying in Rome for now. That's where reporter Rosie Scammell caught up with them. She says they're from a mix of backgrounds and professions, but they're all fleeing the war.
We have a teacher, an atomic researcher, a garden designer amongst them. They decided for various reasons to flee. So some of them, for example, one family who have two teenage boys said specifically that they wanted to flee because they didn't want their teenage boys being drawn up into the army and either being killed or having to kill other people. One of the fathers from another family said that he was called into the army and refused and then fled. So these are the sort of situations that they were leaving behind.
Where are they living right now?
So they're living in a neighborhood called Trastevere, which is fairly close to the Vatican. It's a beautiful neighborhood, very popular with tourists, and many American students actually who come and exchange find themselves in the neighborhood. A lot of people who come as asylum seekers to Italy find themselves in these camps or centers, which are really in the middle of nowhere. So this is quite rare, really, that they're very much in the heart of Rome.
And are they in an apartment? I mean, where are they actually staying?
So for the moment, they're staying in a building run by a Catholic charity, which is tied to the Vatican. This building houses quite a few other asylum seekers. It seems from what the family said, it was quite comfortable accommodation, but they may well be moved to other accommodation.
What is the plan for these families?
Well, the first thing to happen when they landed in Rome was that they formally sought asylum. So they're going through that process in Italy. For some people, that takes a huge amount of time. I met a Syrian yesterday who said that he would be waiting about 6 months. So there'll certainly be a bit of waiting, likely not as long as others would have to wait. They're going to Italian school, so they'll be learning Italian, trying to integrate. And in the future, it's sort of unknown at the moment. They've just arrived and they're trying to find their bearings, really, in Italy.
What are some of the challenges these three families face? I mean, can the adults go out and work?
Their employment rights will be restricted, not only legally because of the difficulties around the asylum process, but also because an unemployment rate is still fairly high in Italy. So it will be difficult for them to find employment. And that's something that I've come across in the past few years amongst refugees from many countries.
Rosie Scammell is a journalist based in Rome. Thanks, Rosie.
Thanks.
Most refugees and migrants awaiting word on asylum don't have the Pope as a sponsor. And as we just heard, many spend months in shelters and camps while they wait. Adeline Sear recently visited a makeshift camp for migrants that sprouted up in Paris.
The metro station Stalingrad in Paris's 19th arrondissement was named after an epic World War II battle. But under this elevated station, you find scenes from another epic struggle, Europe's refugee crisis. Migrants have set up camp here with a few tents and dozens of mattresses laid out in rows. They're bordered by two busy boulevards. 3 weeks ago, Paris officials evacuated almost 1,000 people from the Stalingrad camp and took them to emergency shelters. The city has dismantled 18 camps like this one since June. But Romain Prunier, with the nonprofit United Migrants, says the camp keeps filling up again with new arrivals every day.
So this new camp is more than 200 immigrants, mostly from Sudan, Afghanistan, Eritrea, some of them of west of Africa. What we want is that the City Hall of Paris and the prefecture take their responsibility and give housing for all these immigrants. And we propose an acceleration of the procedure for asylum because now it is very, very long.
In fact, it can take up to a year, something Hossein Hossein, who arrived here 2 weeks ago, is about to face. He's 41, but looks much older. He says he was a lawyer in his native Sudan. He left 12 years ago and has been roaming ever since. Before Paris, he says he spent 7 years in Greece, sleeping anywhere he could, and he did not feel welcome.
Greek people, some part of Greek people, they beat us because they are racist people and they don't like black people to stay there. So we face a lot of problems there, and we eat from garbage, and nobody care about us.
In Greece?
Yes, in Greece.
But you find it better here?
Yes, for me it is better. When I came to France here, and I saw black people, they are free, and I saw black people, they work in police. So for me now, I am relaxed.
But you're warm enough at night, you sleep outside?
Yeah, we sleep here under this bridge, and some French people, they came here and they support us. So it is good for me, and just we are under the bridge.
But tensions do run high in this makeshift camp. People fight over blankets, and earlier in the evening, there was a scuffle on the line waiting for a halal meal, and the food volunteers took off. Saeed Habib used to sleep here. He arrived last August and now lives at a refugee center. He says most of his family has left his native Afghanistan because for young people, he says, it's dangerous to live there.
Because if you live in Afghanistan, you must join one side. If you join one side, then you're against another side. So it's not really comfortable to live in Afghanistan.
Habib says he made it to Britain in 2007 and was deported the year after. So he spent years looking for another asylum country. He's now 26.
I tried to find another country to stay. Unfortunately, the country which is near Afghanistan, they didn't have respect for us like here in Europe. I went to Dubai for 1 month, and I had a plan to stay in Dubai. Unfortunately, there was not a suitable lifestyle for me. And
so now Habib says he can't wait for his asylum request in France to be accepted.
I really, really hope to be accepted here in France. Because I didn't came for money, I just came to live in peace and enjoy the rest of my life. Because everywhere we go, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
For Habib and Hossein, the uncertainty will go on for a while. According to the French Interior Ministry, only a quarter of those who request asylum obtain it. For the World, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Organized crime networks in Latin America have long made their money on drugs, mostly cocaine. But over the past decade, gold prices have soared. So crime networks are increasingly turning to gold mining to make money, illegal gold mining. In fact, cartels in Peru and Colombia are now making more money from exporting illegal gold than from cocaine. That's according to a recent report from the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. Livia Wagner wrote that report and says these mines are a huge driver of human trafficking.
When you arrive in these illegal mines, you just realize that there is like a chain of the victimization, I call it, because you have the miners facing the labor exploitation. They at the same time are exploiting young women, and there is just no way out for them.
You mentioned that girls as young as 12 years old are lured to these mining towns and end up working in brothels. How are they lured there in the first place? Is it the promise of a legitimate job and then it turns out that they're forced into having sex with the workers there?
Well, there are two groups. Of course, the very young girls are told that they can make some money in working as a waitress, for instance. And when they arrive there, then of course they are facing the fact that they're in the middle of nowhere. There is no chance to leave this area. But there's another group of young women that know what is happening, but they still have to go into that situation because they have no alternative livelihood and they have to support their families.
One thing I'm curious about is how this whole thing works. Is it the case where there are just small-time people doing illegal gold mining and then organized crime takes it over? Or does organized crime seeking out places to mine for gold and then selling it?
The situation is very different between, for instance, Colombia and Peru. Because in Peru, the nexus between organized crime is criminals running the mines being related to human traffickers. But in Colombia, you really have the organized crime groups. You have insurgent groups running a mine.
So people like FARC, like FARC rebels?
Yes, yes. And the FARC and the ELN and the Bakrims, they are the ones that are really running the mine.
I understand mercury is used in illegal gold mining to separate the precious metal from other sediment. And then it works its way into the air and the water and the soil. Did you see evidence of mercury poisoning when you were visiting these gold mining villages?
Yes. This was just very shocking for me. I was in an illegal mine in the region of Madre de Dios in Peru, talking to two miners. You can see one miner in a barrel, which is filled with mercury and sand, and he's stepping in the barrel to just try to mix the mercury with the sand.
Remind us what the health consequences are of mercury exposure.
Well, when you inhale the mercury, you can have acute shock and can result in inflammation of vital organs. But it's also the inability to urinate and, of course, death as well. But yes, their feet until their knees are in mercury in these barrels. And you also can see when you go into the illegal mine and you go through very, very dense jungle, you have to go like 1 hour. And then suddenly everything opens up. There is no trees out there anymore. And all you can see is dead trees, like skeletons.
So for people who are looking to buy gold jewelry here in the U.S., is there any way for them to make sure they're not buying illegally mined gold?
Of course, there is. There are many, many initiatives to ensure that. And for instance, the Responsible Jewelry Council has some certification schemes. There is Fairmined, No Dirty Gold campaign. So it definitely is possible. When you want to buy jewelry, then it's easier than if you go and want to buy a laptop and say, okay, where does the gold come from that's in your cell phone or in the laptop? There it's a little bit more difficult.
Livia Wagner is with the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. Thanks, Livia.
Thank you.
We're going to hear now about a Russian man who looks like a World War II veteran. He appears in a snapshot that's become an internet meme. You've probably seen it. The man has Soviet medals pinned to his chest, and he's wiping away tears. My BBC colleague Alex Dakovich has been trying to figure out the man's identity.
Okay, so there's a elderly gentleman. He's holding a balloon and some flowers, which appear to have been handed to him by a crowd kind of lined behind him. It's clearly some kind of parade or some kind of event. He's wearing a load of medals on his chest. He's wiping a tear from his eye. He's clearly very emotional. And above is the text of the meme, and it says, "The last veteran of his World War II battle group marching alone in the Victory Day parade."
And when was the Victory Day parade that this photo's taken from? Do we know that?
Yeah, we managed to find out from contacting the photographer that it was taken on the Victory Day parade in 2007 in St. Petersburg.
So it's interesting. This thing's become a meme. People are still really interested. Why do you think that is?
What's happened is a lot of people from various countries have seen this, and without really analysing it and looking into it too deeply, they've kind of assumed it's someone from their own country. So Australians have said, oh, makes you proud to be Australian, and the same is true of Americans. But obviously there's a lot of people who looked into it a little bit deeper, and it turned out that the photo actually was taken in Russia.
Yeah, I think what really got me, and I assume others, is this guy shedding a tear. And there's something very universal about his sense of tragedy or sadness.
Yes, exactly. And even though the general consensus is that this man may well be a veteran, quite a few people have got in touch with the idea that he might actually be a grieving son or a grieving family member. So, yeah, he's clearly very emotional. I think that is what really resonates with people.
You tracked down the Russian photographer. What did he or she say?
So the photographer's name was Alexander Petrosyan. He remembered taking the photo, but he didn't actually speak to the man. He just took the photograph and, yeah, he didn't know the name of the person. He's just as keen to find out who the man is as we are, really.
Alex, in the photo, this man has a whole lot of medals on his jacket. What did those medals tell you?
Okay, so there's a good chance that he may have been involved in World War II, because on his right-hand side, he's wearing what is called the Order of the Patriotic War, and that they were handed out to anybody who played a part for the Soviet Army.
It's amazing that in 2016, and with the power of the web, that we can't figure out who this guy is.
It is quite surprising, but I think the man is, it looks fairly elderly in the photo, which is unsurprising if he is actually a veteran. So, I mean, he is probably very unlikely to have a social media account, I would have thought, if he's still alive. If enough people in the St. Petersburg area were to be made aware of the photo, and then I'm sure a family member would come forward.
In the end, do you think it's important that we know who this man is?
I don't think it really makes a difference on an emotional level. I think the power of the image is there to see. I guess it would have a bearing on how people felt about the photo, depending on whether or not he turned out to actually be a veteran or not. So I think that would be quite interesting. I'm still in touch with the photographer, and we're constantly checking his Facebook page to see if any more people have responded. There's a good chance that this guy wasn't actually from St. Petersburg, because people travel from far and wide to these events. So maybe we just need to cast a wider net. Lots of people who read the article have been keen to kind of help out and give us a few tips, but we still haven't got that final name, unfortunately.
The BBC's Alex Dakovich. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Thank you.
Coming up, riding the bus to ISIS-controlled territory. You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, a filmmaker tells the story of children living through war in Syria and finds it hard to cope with his own emotions.
I've been struggling, obviously, a lot of times between my role as a documentary filmmaker and as a human being.
Plus, restoring a piece of antiquity lost to ISIS using 3D technology. That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. When President Obama arrives in Saudi Arabia tomorrow, he's heading into uncertain territory. Riyadh and Washington have been allies for decades, since before the creation of Israel. But in the past few years, the relationship has gotten a little shaky. In a recent interview with The Atlantic, Obama called the Saudis free riders, trying to drag the U.S. into conflicts it doesn't need. And he also urged the Saudis to share the neighborhood with their archenemy, Iran. Fahad Nazar is a Saudi and a senior analyst at the global intelligence company JTG in Washington.
There has been no official Saudi response to President Obama's interviews in the Atlantic or any other statements that he's given to the press. However, the Saudi media, both traditional and social media, their reaction was swift and rather overwhelmingly negative, I would say. There have been well over a dozen opinion pieces in mainstream Saudi papers that essentially took this opportunity to not just rebut or answer or respond to what the president said in the interview, but really I think they took the opportunity to assess his legacy in the region overall. And frankly speaking, I don't think that his legacy thus far will be looked upon very favorably. I think that in the eyes of many Saudis, prominent Saudi writers, that the United States under the Obama administration failed to act as the world's sole remaining superpower. Obviously,
in what respect? People
well, I think that from the Saudi view, the instability, the tumultuous events that have gripped the region are in need of a more assertive, hands-on approach, and that's the approach that the Saudis have taken. In some ways, they've adopted a leadership position, I think to a large extent, to fill what they perceive to be a vacuum that has been left by the Obama administration.
Fahad Nazar, in preparing for this interview, I read a lot about how the U.S.-Saudi relationship is in trouble, it's strained. Is that the case, or is that overblown?
No, yes and no. I think there is, my reading at least, that there is a significant, perhaps political divide at the leadership level between the Obama administration and the Saudi leadership. So there is that divide, this disconnect at the top. However, I think there is more to U.S.-Saudi relations than this disagreement at the leadership level. I think so. Obviously, Saudi Arabia and the United States still cooperate very closely in a number of security-related arenas. Saudi Arabia is still supporting the U.S. in its campaign against ISIS. The U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia's campaign in Yemen. The two countries have worked very closely together to cut terrorism financing. Saudi Arabia clearly still has a preference for U.S. weapons. There's a lot of trade back and forth between the two countries. I mean, the mutually beneficial economic interests have really been the anchor of this relationship for decades, and I think that will continue.
Fahad Nazar is a senior analyst at the global intelligence company JTG Inc. Thanks so much, Fahad.
Thank you for having me.
Another point of conflict for the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is the war in Syria. It's something filmmaker Marcel Metelziefen has seen up close. On a trip to Aleppo in 2013, he noticed something he hadn't before. Children were taking on a lot of new responsibilities.
I had a boy called Mohammed, 13 years old, working in a hospital because there were not enough doctors.
So Metelziefen decided to turn his camera on the lives of young Syrians caught in the middle of the war. Sara, Farah, Helen, and Mohammed are the center of his new frontline documentary, Children of Syria. Their father is a well-known opposition leader on the front lines in Aleppo, and his children are right there with him, witnessing the violence and loss. Marcel, what's so startling as a viewer is that these kids, I mean, some of them, when the film starts, are quite young. They seem like ranging in age from maybe, you know, 8 to 14 or something. But they literally kind of play and goof around amidst the shelling. I wondered what you thought of those girls, particularly the young ones, because they seem to have grown up very, very fast.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, I think, the capacity of human beings, of children, to adapt to any kind of circumstances and to still, in a way, keep being children. And this example of them adapting to playing in empty houses is just a proof of so many moments I've been witnessing where children are, yeah, they did not choose in which circumstances they are born in, and they still kind of are able to bring back a little bit of normality in this totally chaos. And it's up to see in the future how big the scars are. They're doing pretty well right now in Germany, and I hope this will end very good. But I'm very sure there have been a lot of other children who are facing a very, very challenging time.
You mentioned the family is now in Germany, and of course this pivotal moment in your documentary is when they're still in Aleppo and their father goes missing and the mother makes the decision that she has to take her children and leave. How hard was that for them?
Oh, this was, I think, the most difficult decision for the mother. And you remember in the film, they've been telling us that they've been waiting 8 years to have their first child. So the children are the most precious thing they had in life. And nevertheless, they were able and ready to risk everything for the country, for the revolution. And they and the mother, when the father got missing, kidnapped by ISIS, by the ones who hijacked their revolution, she had to understand that she cannot stay any longer and that she is now faced a double front, the regime and the Islamic State. So she had to leave and she had to go and become a refugee. She had to leave a country she never wanted to leave.
When this family arrives in Germany, they're sent to a somewhat smallish town in northern Germany. And what's amazing is the kids, for the most part, readily adapt and they are welcomed. But the mother just metaphorically disappears. She really shuts down. How does she spend her days?
Well, I think there I tell the story of thousands of families who've been going exactly the same path. The first, second generation of migrants who are able to adapt pretty much into their new environment, especially if you're young. The parents, they are physically there, but emotionally, obviously, especially Hala, the mother, is still looking for the father. With all these rumors, if he might be still alive in prison or dead, and she just don't know what's going on. And there are all these rumors coming up every day. And so she's trapped. And the only reason why she came and she made it to Germany is because she wanted to secure the future of her children.
Marcel, what was it like for you personally to shoot this documentary?
Well, if you do a project which takes 3 years and you're able to get so close to a family which been going through very hard times, you obviously get very emotional involved. And I'm basically part of the family right now. And I've been struggling, obviously, a lot of times between my role as a documentary filmmaker and as a human being. And it was challenging. It was very, very challenging. And I'm actually right now very happy and relieved that we made it. And I think there is a strong film there.
How's the family doing now?
The family's been doing very well. The children are speaking German. As you can see, the development between the oldest sister and Mohammed, the brother, are quite different. She is a teenaged girl with the normal problems of a teenage girl in Germany, and she wants to become and be as more German as possible. And Mohammed is trying to keep more of this Syrian Arabic roots.
Filmmaker Marcel Metazifen, his new Frontline documentary is Children of Syria. It airs tonight on PBS. If you were to make a list of the most dangerous places in the world, ISIS territory in Syria would rank near the top. Bombings, kidnappings, and execution are a daily part of life. But what if it was your job to actually go there on a regular basis? Richard Hall with our Global Post team met a man at a Beirut bus station who makes the trip once a week.
Shalhalu bus station is a greyish-brown Soviet-looking building that was once a parking garage. It's a very busy place.
So people are loading up bags and boxes, heading home to see relatives, that kind of thing. It's a nice atmosphere down here, despite a strong smell of urine coming from the darker corners of the building. But there's one man who isn't smiling, a bus driver I'll call Ahmed. He has a very difficult journey ahead of him.
There are drones. There's ISIS. There's bombing by the Syrian regime. We face all of these dangers on these trips.
Once a week, Ahmed drives his bus from Beirut deep into ISIS-controlled territory. He's a 49-year-old Syrian. For obvious reasons, he doesn't want to give us his real name.
Once there was a bombing in front of us. A bus was hit. We're constantly in danger.
In a couple of hours, he'll set off for Minbij, a Syrian town run by ISIS. I ask him what goes through his head before he sets off on a trip like this.
I am constantly in total fear. I just want to get home safely.
Ahmed tells me that before he reaches the first ISIS checkpoint, he stops the bus and all the passengers undergo a transformation.
The woman put the black veil on. Nothing should show. And we have to pull our pants and throw away our cigarettes. The women start off wearing regular clothes in Beirut and regime areas, then cover up to the point their eyes can't even show when we approach ISIS. We have to take all of these precautions.
Minbij is in northern Syria, but to get there, Ahmed takes a ridiculously circuitous route. A journey that should take him a few hours will take him 3 days. He seems close to tears when he talks about the journey ahead.
ISIS makes your life a living hell just to pass. We need the people to understand that this job isn't easy and we go through a lot every single day. I'm going to cry.
Before the war, thousands of Syrians and Lebanese would go back and forth across the border every day. Now it's probably closer to dozens. Even up until a few weeks ago, buses from Beirut to the ISIS capital of Raqqa were still a big moneymaker. But Imad, who runs the bus company where Ahmed works, says the journey's been getting more dangerous. A lot of drivers just don't want to do it anymore, and business is suffering.
They always had to grow their beards longer and not smoke. People were sick and tired of going through all these ISIS rules, so they just stopped going.
Imad said he wouldn't do it, but Ahmed still does. He has to take care of 11 family members still in Syria. He only makes $30 for the entire trip, no matter how long it takes. But there aren't many options for Syrians looking for work in Lebanon.
This is the only job I can do. I can't do anything else. What am I going to do? Be a construction worker. I don't have the build to be a construction worker. This is my only option.
As if the job wasn't bad enough already, the drivers now have to worry about a strict set of new rules for Syrians coming into Lebanon. Ahmed tells me the new laws put him at the mercy of gangs and smugglers on the border. And yet, when I ask him which border he prefers crossing, the one to Lebanon or the one into ISIS areas, he's very clear. He says definitely the crossing into Lebanon. With ISIS, anything wrong and you're beheaded. For the World, Richard Hall, Beirut.
Just before we head to the break, an encouraging story about the Syrian city of Palmyra. Up until recently, ISIS controlled the ancient city, and they destroyed precious monuments and artifacts, including the Arch of Triumph. But today, the arch is back with the help of 3D printing. The Oxford-based Institute for Digital Archaeology made a smaller replica, and it's on display in London's Trafalgar Square. Alexei Karanowska is technology director at the Institute, and she explains how they did it.
We start with assembling photographs that give a full 360-degree view of the object. Those photographs are then used to make a 3D model on a computer, so a virtual model. And we look at how we can actually turn that into something that's solid and made out of stone. And then the next step is to use the 3D model that results from that process. So that file, that digital information, is used as the input to a very sophisticated 3D machining piece of equipment that has at its heart an articulated arm, a little bit like the ones that you may have seen on car assembly lines. On the end of the arm, there is a small cutting tool, and that cutting tool moves through space to recreate the surface detail that is encoded in the digital file in the surface of a piece of stone.
This thing is actually made of stone?
It's solid marble, that's right.
Could you use 3D printing technology to rebuild the arch back in Palmyra?
Yes. So this project at its point of conception was one which was about trying to develop technologies that are useful in the process of restoration and reconstruction. We know that this arch was leveled. It is the case, though, that big pieces of it still exist in Palmyra. So it's really a combination of this complete recreation technology and restoration technologies that we'll potentially see being used on that site.
That was Alexei Karanowska with the Institute for Digital Archaeology, which made a replica of Palmyra's Arch of Triumph. It's now on display in London and will travel to other spots around the world, including New York. You're listening to The World. The Panama Papers have shed light on how celebrities and world leaders set up shell companies to stash their wealth, exploiting tax havens like the Cayman Islands. But you don't need a tropical island to hide your money. Take the case of Ricardo Teixeira. He's the former head of Brazil's National Soccer Federation, and he's embroiled in allegations of fraud and graft in the U.S. and Brazil. He also seems to be behind a shell company registered in Florida. Tim Padgett is the Americas editor at WLRN in Miami, and he's been investigating Teixeira.
In 2012, when Brazilian investigators and Swiss investigators, I should add, were closing in on him, Ricardo Teixeira fled Brazil in a hurry and suddenly showed up in Miami. It was widely believed that he had taken his allegedly corrupt tens of millions of dollars and brought them to Florida. What he did was he had his wife set up a shell company here in Florida. It was called Ochab Properties. And through that shell company, Teixeira was able to buy a $7.4 million mansion on a beautiful stretch of islands near Miami Beach called Sunset Islands.
Describe this place to us non-Floridians.
The Sunset Islands is home to superstar celebrities like Shakira. It is home to multi-million dollar mansions where you'll often find 68-foot yachts docked next to the homes. Teixeira himself had one of those. It's the kind of place where people like Ricardo Teixeira are looking to park questionable assets. That kind of shell company also helps them with taxes as well.
So you use the past tense when talking about Teixeira and his mansion in Sunset Islands. Where is he now?
Last year, when the U.S. started cracking down on soccer corruption, as you recall, Teixeira, I think, started getting wind that he himself was about to be indicted. So OCHA Properties hurriedly put that mansion on the block. They were trying to get about $12 million or so for it, but they only ended up getting $9 million. It was sold in September. And then, lo and behold, about 3 months later in December, Ricardo Teixeira was indicted by the U.S. government on racketeering charges. But by then, he had fled to Brazil with his now $9 million and other assets.
These shell companies are illegal, and now the U.S. is concerned with the abuse of them as a means to launder money. And I understand the Treasury Department has started a pilot program in Miami to address this. What are they doing?
The Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Unit, known as FinCEN, in January, it started a pilot program focused on Manhattan and Miami, which are really the two epicenters of this problem in the United States. And what they are doing is they are requiring certain title companies, companies that handle property title, and in Florida, those are often attorneys. It's requiring them to report what's known as the ultimate beneficiaries, people like Ricardo Teixeira, behind these shell companies that are being used to conceal not only their assets, but their identities. It'll be interesting to see how that works out. A lot of people feel that it's not a real substitution for actual legislation to require law firms to report the real beneficiaries of these shell companies.
In the Teixeira case, Ricardo Teixeira, he's now back in Brazil. What recourse does the U.S. have in going after him?
Not much. There is no real extradition apparatus set up right now to bring him back. And I think that's one of the things that frustrates U.S. investigators. I think they feel that had they been more certain that Ricardo Teixeira was the ultimate beneficiary of this property company set up to help him buy this mansion, perhaps they could have gone after him sooner and they could have frozen those assets before he was able to take them out of the United States again.
Tim Padgett is the Americas editor at WLRN in Miami. He's been looking into the use of shell companies in Miami. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Finally today, we often talk to our friend, food writer Steve Dolinsky, about the dishes he samples on his travels. Last time we talked to him, he was in Osaka, Japan. This week, Steve's in Mexico. He's on vacation with his family in the resort town of Playa del Carmen on the Yucatan. Steve, thanks for taking a break from the beach to talk to us. How's the food?
The food, Carol, is a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I'm actually just sitting in a cafe right now. Lots of tourist shops, of course, and you would expect to see, like, the Senor Frogs and the tequila shots and the partiers for spring break. But for someone like me who comes here, I'm just looking for interesting food.
So what have you found?
Well, a little taco cart where they specialize in cecina. That's an air-dried and salt-cured beef. They chop it very fine. They grill it over hardwood. They chop it fine, serve it with nopales, which is that boiled cactus you see almost everywhere here in the Yucatan. Lots of different salsas, including habanero. Very simple peasant food, hearty food to fill you up for a day of working outside here in the sun. But then something like carnitas, fried pork, and it comes with spicy guacamole, different kinds of salsa, chicharron, which is the fried pork skin, lots of fresh lime. Homemade tortillas. You don't see them everywhere in the tourist section, but when you walk like 10 minutes outside of this main tourist hub of Playa del Carmen, you can find a lot of great eating here, like little cocktails, you know, shrimp cocktails, octopus cocktails, homemade ceviche, made a la minute, made with the freshest lime juice. Even some, you know, in the tourist section, there's a place that's about a month and a half old called Sea Grill, and there's a chef there, Pedro Abascal, and he talked to me about some of the local ingredients that he is able to find here all within an hour of his kitchen.
We use lamb that's come from a town really nearby. It's called Tisimin. The same for fish, lobster, the octopus.
There's an interesting sauce. There's a black sauce,
yes.
Kind of a charred chili.
That's called recado negro for a typical dish from this region that's called relleno negro. So this is a paste made with masa, corn dough, with charred chiles, and some spices.
Steve, what kind of spices did he use?
Surprised to hear he uses cumin and clove and then oregano, not the Greek oregano. This is a local Mexican oregano. So cumin, clove, and oregano with those charred chilies. The habaneros, by the way, he also uses them, he says, to make black beans. One of his other ingredients, by the way, is wood. He said it's very important to find zapote, a local wood, that he grills just about everything over, local wood.
What's the noontime scene like at the taco cart there? Long lines?
Several lines. There's a line to get the cecina to go because some people want to just, you know, pack it up, bring it home and cook it. Some people want to have like two tacos and then dress it themselves. And I love all the assortment of different things you can have. So not just the cebolla y cilantro, the white onion and cilantro, but also zucchini and, again, those charred and the raw salsa. You'll definitely see sort of a queue for ordering the tacos, but then you'll see another queue for people ordering to go and then cook it at home. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, there's music playing and there's people hanging out and you hear the sort of the whack, whack, whack chopping up the beef and you hear the sizzle over the hardwood or over the local wood cooking, and it's just a lot of local color. The food always tastes a little bit better that way to me.
Food writer Steve Dolinsky in Playa del Carmen on the Yucatan in Mexico. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Buen provecho.
A quick taste of Playa del Carmen there to close our show. We've posted photos and Steve's recipe for Yucatan-style habanero salsa at PRI.org. But beware, the salsa comes with a warning because it's hot. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.